Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Who are the greatest players in NFL history wear jersey number 76? Well, historian George Bozica, who specializes in Ohio sports, is joining us because there are some great Ohio players who wore 76 in the NFL. It's all coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen. We have another bonus edition, our football by number series, jersey number 76 tonight. And we have our good friend George Bozica here, a great historian from the Pro Football Research Association, and lives in the town of Canton, Ohio, where the Pro Football Hall of Fame is, where pro football started. George Bozica, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thanks, Darren. Always glad to join you for these discussions.
Yeah, we love to have your expertise and your insight into this. And we've got some guys from that played in your neck of the woods coming up here from your favorite team. So I'm excited to hear what you have to say about them.
Yeah, I was really excited when I started getting into this. I was really excited myself. I knew a couple, but I was surprised of the number of 76 players with that number that have Ohio connections. It really amazed me.
Yeah, it truly is. Well, let me just mention real quick who the Pro Football Hall of Fame recognizes word number 76 before we get going. Then we'll go into detail on them if you don't mind. They have in no particular order: Lou Groza, Marion Motley, Lou Kriegmer, Orlando Pace, Bob Brown, and the newly enshrined Steve Hutchinson.
Correct. Yeah, Steve Hutchinson. His enshrinement was completed over the weekend in the class of 2020. Which was really, I actually saw him in the parade.
Yeah. Quite an emotional thing. They had up on the screen during his person presenting him. Mm-hmm. I forget who it was that presented him. They had him up there, and David Baker, the president of the Hall of Fame, must have been in their hotel rooms earlier in the week or earlier that day, and knocked on their door. And Hutchinson was so emotionally excited about being enshrined. I mean, he was in tears. His family was in tears. It was really a amazing moment during the Hall of Fame weekend to see that. And glad we got to see part of that. You don't think about those big football guys of being in tears, but the guy was just so emotionally happy to be there. You could tell he waited a long time and deserved it.
Yeah, it's always amazing to me, having been to a number of enshrinements over the years, how many of them get, you know, very emotional in the moment. And that's the knocking on the door is a tradition that Dave Baker has sort of started, how he will go. And I've seen other ones that he's done where he'll go to wherever, you know, the person is, and they'll knock on the door and announce that they're being inducted, and always gets, you know, a really emotional response. But yeah, it's always amazing. I know a couple of the enshrinees even say, well, I said I'm not going to cry, I'm not going to break down. But you know, you can hear the voices crack when they talk about, you know, certain things during their career, certain coaches or family or stuff like that. So it's nice to see that they're real people, I guess, you know. And I was impressed with a number of the enshrinement speeches this past weekend.
Yeah, most definitely. They all did a great job, and congratulations to everybody from both the 2020 and 2021 classes, especially those guys from 2020. They had to wait a year to get up on stage there. So
They did. That was a long wait, but I'm sure they were excited. They all looked excited.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. And quite a buzz going around Canton last weekend, because I believe that was the first football game that could have first full capacity in like, you know, 18 months or something. You know?
Yeah, it was, because last year with the high school season, which played, it's also played, number of games are played in the Stark County area. They were not allowed, you know, full capacity for those or for the state playoffs or anything. So it was mostly parents and relatives, and you know, that was about it. So it was really unusual last year to see some of the crowds at some of the games, because it just wasn't what we're used to in Stark County.
Well, tremendous weekend. Your city and the Pro Football Hall of Fame did a wonderful job, and I think everybody that attended or watched on television felt that way, and it's much appreciated. Kudos to Canton, Ohio.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we're very proud of the Hall of Fame.
Okay. Well, I guess we got to get down to business, because we have some great players to talk about, and there's a lot of them that wore 76, and I'm excited to hear what you have to say about these guys.
Sure. Well, you know, the way we did this last time was we sort of gave the best of at the beginning, and I believe without question, didn't have to put a lot of thought in it. Number one on my list is Marion Motley. In fact, he's one of the few, if not the only, number 76 on here that that was a running back. But I mean, I just think Marion Motley's story is amazing. He, you know, he was born in Leesburg, Georgia, but he grew up in Canton, Ohio. He attended Canton McKinley High School, where he was a running back, and he averaged, believe this or not, he averaged 17.2 yards a carry at Canton McKinley.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And actually, during his years there, the only games they lost were to Maslin and a guy who turned out to be a pretty good coach, Paul Brown, who was in Maslin at the time.
Wow.
And I don't think Paul Brown ever forgot Marion Motley.
I guess not. Did Canton McKinley ever have a second down to have to play on offense?
That's a good question. When Motley on the field, they wouldn't have had to. He was just amazing. Actually, my dad told me a story. He remembered seeing when he was a police boy back then. You know how they had the junior police. Mm-hmm. And he said he remembers going to Fawcett Stadium, which is now, you know, Benson. But he remembers going to Fawcett Stadium to see McKinley play Dover. And Marion Motley ran for 4 touchdowns that day. So he remembers that from his childhood. So he was an amazing player. He later played at Nevada, where he starred also, and he played for Jimmy Aiken there. And Jimmy Aiken also has a Canton McKinley tie, because he was the coach at McKinley just prior to Johnny Reed, who was a coach during Motley's years. And Jimmy Aiken was a fantastic coach. He also coached Norm Van Brocklin at Oregon. So he had quite a coaching career, but he got his start at or at least came to fame. He did coach, as I recall, before he got to McKinley, but he sort of came to fame in McKinley and had a great team in 1934 in McKinley that went 11-0 and just, you know, pounded everybody. In fact, his 1934 team, I'm sort of digressing here from Marion Motley, but it all comes full circle. His 34 team played Paul Brown's 34 team. Both were undefeated at that year. And it was amazing. They had like 24,000 people. The Goodyear blimp was there. You know, this isn't your normal high school, you know, football or normal high school rivalry. It's one of the greatest in the country. After Nevada, he played at Great Lakes for Paul Brown. And then eventually Paul Brown invited him to camp with the Browns. And he took part in the reintegration of pro football. It was 2 players with the Rams. Woody Strode, who later went on to be an actor, and Kenny Washington. And it was Marion Motley and Bill Willis for the Browns. And in fact, we were mentioning before we started taping that you got to see the 11 in downtown Canton this past weekend while you were in town. One of the 11, and for people that don't know what the 11 is, it's basically 11 pieces of artwork that are in downtown Canton that have been sort of erected over the last couple of years, which are 11 key moments in pro football history. And one of them is a reintegration of pro football. And there's a huge mural that depicts the 4 players that were instrumental. So not only was Marion Motley a great football player, he was also a pioneer in terms of, you know, dealing with that. And, you know, from stories I've read, you know, it was not easy for him and for those other players. This was a full year before Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. In fact, my understanding from what I've read and researched is that Branch Rickey was really affected by the fact that, you know, four players could reintegrate a contact sport, and it made him believe that he could then break the color barrier in baseball by bringing Jackie Robinson in. So, you know, it was instrumental in what he did, you know, the year later, bringing, you know, Jackie Robinson and up into the Dodgers organization.
And Jackie Robinson was quite a great football player at UCLA.
He was. Yeah, definitely. And he, in fact, Kenny Washington was also at UCLA. So he started a great career with the Browns. He's a member of the 100th anniversary team. He's a member of the 1940s All-Decade team. He averaged 5.7 yards a carry with the Browns. Hall of Fame in 1968. He also was a great linebacker for the Browns because back then, you know, a lot of these guys played two ways. So, you know, Paul Brown always considered him his best back, even above Jim Brown. Paul Zimmerman, in his famous book, Thinking Man's Guide to Pro Football, said he was the greatest player ever. Otto Graham said that, you know, he was the greatest all-around fullback that he's ever seen. Those are some, you know, pretty worthy, you know, people that basically felt that he was one of the best ever. So I think without question, you know, Marion Motley is at the top of my list. He just was an amazing player. You know, unfortunately, you know, the times, you know, too, he wanted to become more involved as an administrator after he retired. And, you know, he always felt that, from stories I've read, that, you know, that his color held him back. So, you know, there was something sort of a bittersweet situation with him. And oddly enough, he finished his career with the Steelers because after he was his career ended with the Browns,
he finally saw the light side.
Yeah, I guess. So, yeah, but he actually just recently, they're going to be, if everything goes according to plan, they're going to be putting up a Marion Motley statue in Canton.
Nice.
Had some festivities recently to sort of get that going, but it's been a fundraising thing for a while now. And a local group of people, you know, want him to be remembered in Canton and, felt that it was an appropriate thing to have a statue of him in the city. So they're working on that. So hopefully we're going to see that here in the near future.
I was downtown Canton over the weekend and got to witness all the 11. And the mural that you're talking about for the integrations on the side of a parking garage.
Yes,
and I'm just going to give a little plug. I parked in that parking garage. We were trying to find some place to eat. And of course, after the parade, everything was closed.
Yeah.
Except we found the Canton Brewery downtown. So we parked in that parking garage, which was right next to the brewery. And yes. What a great place that is. Going to great food. By the way, if you're ever in Canton, folks, get a chance to go down there. Yeah. But the history inside that place was amazing.
Yeah.
They had the one like a little mural set up, and they had a picture of, you know, the famous Ralph Hay Hutmobile showroom of the first meeting, September 17, 1920. And they had a little caption underneath that the beer that they were drinking was made at that brewery. That was their claim. So pretty cool. And then going down to the restroom, there's like a speakeasy down there. You could tell it was a very old building, but very cool building and a great place to have a bite to eat.
Yeah. There's a couple of really good places in downtown Canton. The other restaurant that has the tie to the NFL is Bender's, which is one of the oldest restaurants in town. And actually, we had a luncheon there during our Pro Football Research Association convention last month. But it's also and it's right next to another one of the 11, the Monday Night Football mural.
And right across the street almost from the Ralph Hay.
It is.
Founding of football. Yeah, that was our intention, was to eat there, but they were closed that Saturday.
Yeah, they were closed on Saturday. I think they opened for a dinner service, but I also remember hearing that a lot of these restaurants, you know, during the summer take a 2-week, but I'm guessing that they probably were going to be open for the dinner service. But I noticed that too, because we parked near there for the parade and we walked by and saw that they were closed for lunch service, so at any rate, but that's definitely a great place. They're definitely involved in the history of the league, and it's a great place to eat. So in addition to, as you said, the Canton Brewery, downtown Canton, just to toot the horn for my hometown, is they're really doing great things downtown to bring football into the downtown area. I don't know if you had a chance to see Centennial Plaza.
I did.
Yeah. And they have pylons there with the names of everybody that's, you know, played in the league, which is really impressive.
Yeah, that was in addition to the 11, and they had a couple other buildings that were painted. They had one with the Canton versus Massillon game on a big
mural, yeah.
which is part of the 11. Yeah. And they had another one, I think it was a Jim Thorpe that wasn't part of the 11, I believe. Very cool downtown. If everybody gets a chance to take that walk, it was definitely worth it.
Yeah, it's worth a visit. Yeah. So getting back, my second person on my list of sort of my best of is Lou Groza. And Lou Groza also has Ohio tie. Lou Groza played at Martins Ferry High School, which is actually, this is sort of an aside, an interesting sort of tidbit. Martins Ferry is the subject of what I found, and I had known about it before, but it's one of the most famous poems, considered by most one of the, like, the best poems ever written, and it's called Autumn Begins in Martins Ferry, Ohio. And it's about, you know, the poem is actually about, like, working class towns and everything else, but the underlying theme of the poem is football. And it's if you ever have a chance, anybody that listens, you got to check it out. There's some really interesting things on the website about the poem and about Martins Ferry. It's sort of on the far western part of the state that sort of borders on Pennsylvania. And it's another area, big football area, blue collar, steel, and everything else in those areas. He went on to Ohio State University and then the Army. And then during World War II, I found this really interesting, something I didn't know. He was a surgical technician during the war, which I thought was really an interesting aside. He had a brother, Alex, who was actually as good a basketball player as Lou was a football player. He played on some national championship teams with Kentucky. Lou was also his best known because of his famous nickname, the Toe. When he retired, he was the leading kicker and leading scorer in NFL history when he retired in 1967. He was at the top of the list at that time. And he was also a good offensive lineman. He, of course, won the 1950 championship game over the Rams with a game-winning field goal late in the game. And he was – I know this is strange to maybe you're more younger listeners, he was a straight on kicker, which is, you know, obviously we don't see any straight on kickers anymore, but those of us of a certain vintage remember the straight on kickers.
And that's for
Lou,
sure.
Lou was a straight on kicker. He was on the 1950s all decade team, and he's also a member of the Hall of Fame from 1974. I have a personal story too. My dad worked for the Diebold Corporation in Canton. They were a banking equipment company. He was a factory worker. I grew up in a blue collar home, and Lou Groza during the off season, and many of these guys back during the 50s and 60s during the off season, you know, these players didn't make the kind of money these guys make now. Right. So a lot of these guys did something in the off season. Well, Lou Groza was sort of like a PR representative for Diebold's. And my dad got me a signed Lou Groza photo from Lou Groza when he went through the plant one day. And I still have that in my collection. So that's sort of my personal Lou Groza story. I also rode on an elevator one time with Marion Motley, and I didn't even say hi to him. I kick myself to this day. I told my sons when I got home, I rode on an elevator with Marion Motley day, and they said, "You didn't say hello?" I said, "No." I said, "I guess I froze up in the presence of greatness, I guess."
Well, didn't I read somewhere that Motley had talked at a bunch of different PFRA conventions and or meetings?
I don't know. If it was before my time.
Okay.
It was before my time. Yeah, it would have been before my time, because he later went to work for the state of Ohio. He worked for one of the state agencies, and that's how I happened to see him, because the building that I worked in, the office building I worked in, I worked for the city of Akron for 30 years, and the office building I worked in was also an office building that had state offices in it. So I believe he was there probably because he was going up the elevator the same time I was going to my office, but I think he was going up to some of the offices and the floors above us where they had some state offices. And I looked at him, I knew immediately who he was, and I just froze. And then after he got off the elevator, I said, "Geez, what an idiot I am. I never even said hello."
Hey, but you got the experience.
The funny thing was a relative of his in Canton became a city councilman for a number of years. And the councilman knew my dad real well because we would see him at games and always say hi to my dad because they knew each other growing up. And, you know, I had that as a sort of a contact to open a, you know, a conversation with him. And I just, like I said, I froze. So,
Any normal person would. I probably would have done the same thing. You get a little bit shell shocked. And
yeah, you do. You really
turn
do.
Fanboy real quick, don't you?
Yeah, you do. You really do. So Lou Groza, third on my list. Continuing with the Ohio theme, Orlando Pace, one of the great offensive linemen.
Absolutely.
Grew up in Sandusky, Ohio, which is another old traditional high school football town in Ohio. He also played at the Ohio State University. He was an offensive tackle there. He became sort of famous for his pancake blocks. He's a college and pro football Hall of Famer. He was drafted, you know, first overall in 1997, 7-time Pro Bowler, 3-time All Pro, 2000s All Decade Team. He was obviously with the Rams. I think we most remember his career with the Rams. He was part of that Greatest Show on Turf. He was on that offensive line, you know, blocking for Kurt Warner, and obviously. Super Bowl 34 winners in that exciting game over the Titans, where the Titans almost were on the doorstep and were stopped on the doorstep.
Had a half yard line to end the game.
And I found out this interesting tidbit about him. He at one time had a restaurant called, and it just figures, Big O's, because he was a big guy. So Orlando Pace would be definitely third on my list.
Great choices so far.
Yeah. Sticking with the Hall of Famers, next one on my list is Lou Kriegmer. Played for the great 1950s Detroit Lions teams. He was an 8-time Pro Bowler, 6-time All-Pro offensive lineman, also played a little bit of defense. He played, at one point in his career, he played 165 straight games, which I think is just amazing for an offensive lineman.
Sure is.
He was a 3-time NFL champion with those great Lions teams. You know, I think sometimes people see the recent vintage Lions. I think people forget how good the Lions were in the 1950s, you know, with Bobby Lane and Doak Walker and Horschemeyer. And just they were just, you know, Buddy Parker was their coach, obviously, for a couple of those championships. And then George Wilson. But he also made it into the Hall of Fame. Finally, had to wait a number of years to get into the Hall of Fame. It was well deserving. He made it in 1996. And he was known as being just an outstanding blocker. So, but you know, I think when they talk about sort of mini dynasties, I think you almost have to consider those Lions teams. And they were just, you know, they were the one team with the Rams that in the early part of the 50s seemed to be able to go toe to toe with the Browns, during that run that the Browns had, cause you had the Lions and then you had the Rams and then, later in the decade, obviously, the Giants started to go toe-to-toe. And then they sort of took over in about the mid-50s there when they won their championship in 56. They sort of took over and then, you know, won the Eastern, you know, in 56, 58, 59, played the Colts, obviously. And then they had that great run at the beginning of the 60s when Y.A. Tittle was their quarterback with the Giants. But I think people sometimes, when you talk about great teams, I think most historians know the Lions, but I think a lot of people, you know, just don't remember that far back. You know, it's that pre-Super Bowl history sometimes that's forgotten by a lot of people.
Yeah, you go through some of the old footage and everything, and you look at their defensive backfield that those Detroit Lions teams had. You know, Dick LeBeau and another great Hall of Fame cornerback, and his name escapes me right now, but there's, you know, two or three for the defensive backfield that are in the Hall of Fame besides LeBeau.
No, they did. They always had great defenses, even going into the 60s with Alex Karras, who obviously was just inducted this past. Well, actually, his induction ceremony was a little bit earlier in the year because they had the posthumous enshrinement ceremony that they showed on NFL Network for some of those that centennial class that had passed away, and Alex Karras was one of those, and he was another one that was well deserving. So but yeah, they had done, you know, all those great defenses during the 60s, which I'll actually get into because we have a number 76 that played for the Lions during that time frame, which I'll get into a little later.
Okay.
he's one of my sort of extras that didn't quite make the best of, but was right behind the best of. Next on my list is Bob Brown, Big Bob Brown, nicknamed the Boomer, big guy. And also another, this is 4 for 5, another Ohio connection. He hailed from Cleveland East Tech High School. And I got to tell you about Cleveland East Tech. Cleveland East Tech is actually known more as a basketball school. They had some of the greatest teams in the history of Ohio high school basketball in the late 50s. They used to just scare teams because I would have been 4 or 5 years old then, but they won back-to-back state championships back then, beat all comers. And what they would do to intimidate the other team is they would come out on the floor and I've heard this, and it may be an urban legend, but I heard that every player on the team could dunk the ball.
Wow.
And they would basically all put on a dunkathon during the pregame. And that would just, you know, here they were already the best team in the state. And you can imagine what, you know, the other team's looking down here and we got to play this group, you know? So, yeah, so that's where he hailed, but they're more as a basketball school.
They might be the original Phi Slamma Jamma.
Yeah. Yeah. They were something else. He then went to Nebraska where he also started. And then he ended up, being a great, lineman with mostly known for the Eagles, also played with the Rams and the Raiders, 60s all decade team, college and Pro Football Hall of Famer, 6-time Pro Bowler, 5-time All Pro. He was known for his great work ethic, and he believed his goal, from what I read and some of my research, was to wear down the opponent physically and mentally. That's what he wanted to do by just pounding constantly until, you know, finally he won that battle. And that's the kind of player he was. But, I read that his son, who ended up being an attorney, said that, you know, he was a great example, you know, in the family because he was such a hard worker and had that great work ethic. So he's definitely up there. And then the last of my sort of best of is the person we mentioned at the outset, who was just inducted in the Hall of Fame, Steve Hutchinson. Unfortunately, he excelled at that team that we like to call that team up north here in Ohio, the University of Michigan. That's where he excelled. You know, the famous story is that Woody Hayes, when he was coach at Ohio State, ran out of gas in Michigan and he didn't want to spend money. So he pushed the car over the state line so he could buy the gas in Ohio. Or the other famous story was the year that he beat them when he won the national championship in 68. The other famous story with Woody Hayes in Michigan was because he went for 2 at the end to put 50 on them, which he later came to regret the next year when he was upset by Michigan. But they asked him after the game, "Coach, why'd you go for 2 at the end?" He said, "Because I couldn't go for 3." So, so just a couple of Woody Hayes stories. Hutchinson was offensive guard, Seattle, Minnesota, Tennessee, 7-time Pro Bowler, 5-time All Pro, all 2000s team. And obviously, as we said before, he was just inducted into the Hall of Fame. And he sort of completes the best of. Those are the 6 Hall of Famers that wore 76. Marion Mahle at the top of the list, Lou Groza, Orlando Pace, Lou Kriegmer, Bob Brown, and Steve Hutchinson.
You can't go wrong with that. Seven great players.
That's a darn good group right there. And I said that, you know, the interesting thing, and that was only because obviously didn't have the numbering system that we have today. Marion Mahle was a famous running back wearing that unusual number 76. You know, one time Otto Graham wore number 60 during his career. So that was before the standardized numbering system.
Yeah. I guess what happened is when the AAFC merged, the AAFC allowed them to wear any numbers they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And when they merged with the NFL in 1950, it took the NFL a couple of years to figure out, hey, these guys are wearing the numbering system's a little off here, right? It's throwing off, you know, eligible receivers and things of that sort. So the 1952, they instilled the rules that we knew for the last 4 decades until this year. So with the numbering rules in the NFL. So it looked almost like, Motley gave up the 76 and went to 36, and then Groza went from 46 to 76 when Motley gave up the numbers, what it looks like with the Browns.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but Yeah, those are the numbers. But I remember seeing pictures of Molly too with that number on. You know, there's that famous video from NFL Films where he breaks, like, it seems like 10 tackles on his way to the end zone, finally loses his helmet and everything else. It's one of the most amazing runs. That was always played, it seemed like, over and over again on NFL Films. I always remember that. And then, you know, Groza with, you know, he was one of, I think, the first true, you know, sort of kicker specialist, because, you know, before that, you know, a lot of time the kickers were just, you know, players that played another position and they also kicked. I mean, you can think back, you know, back during that vintage, you know, you had Paul Horney, who was also, you know, running back, but he was also a kicker. And, you know, you had others that did that too. Bob Waterfield, obviously a quarterback for the Rams, but he also kicked and punted for them. So, and those are just a couple of examples that immediately come to mind. But, you know, now kicking obviously has become, you know, a specialized position, you know, and it's just, you know, amazing. I remember too, hearing when I was a kid that Groza, I remember seeing the kid play in a game too. Apparently he was working with a local kid who was a kicker. And I remember seeing the kid kick in high school. He was also a straight on kicker. And I remember being amazed at how this kid was kicking the ball. So, I mean, it seemed like Groza not only was a good, you know, kicker himself, but it seemed like he must have been a pretty good, you know, coach too, in terms of, you know, coaching this kid. He came out of Ravenna, which is another high school here in the area. It's another small town here in the area, but I remember being amazed at how this kid was kicking the ball at the high school level straight on. So, yeah, he was something else.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah. Okay, so now we're out of the Hall of Famers. Yeah. You chose all seven of them. I totally agree with all seven of them.
Right.
So who do you have coming up that's not yet in the Hall of Fame, we'll call them?
Yeah, sort of. And, you know, these are all people that, you know, might sometime get in. I think one that's interesting to me is Steve Wisniewski, who played for the Raiders. 8-time Pro Bowler, offensive guard, 2-time All-Pro, all 1990s teams. He played for part of his career at the Raiders for John Gruden. And the one thing, some of the things that Gruden said was that he was just, you know, an old school pro, you know, even though he played obviously in the 1990s, but he said that he was one of those guys that was always prepared, always an example to the younger players on the team. You know, he said that, you know, he had this reputation as being such a good ball player and, you know, sort of a fierce warrior on the field, but he said off the field, and this is so true, you hear these stories, you know, he said off the field, he was, you know, just the nicest guy. You know, I remember for some of your listeners who maybe didn't make it to the Pro Football Researchers weekend, we had, during our player panel, we had Mark Miller, who played for the Browns a couple of years, and Lyle Alzado was a teammate for a couple of years, and he was telling the story about how, you know, everybody knows Lyle Alzado on the field, you know, what a sort of a crazy man he was. And he was saying that, you know, Lyle Alzado sort of invited himself to stay with Mark at his home. And he said, you know, he couldn't have been a nicer guy. He was helping his wife do the dishes and everything else, you know? So it just, you know, you just never know. These guys have one persona on the field and another persona off the field. So I think he's sort of, you know, at the top of the list of those that have not. You know, the funny thing that I found is I did research on everybody that was on the list awarded number 76 is a lot of these guys had long careers as offensive or defensive linemen, but whether they flew under the radar or whatever, there was only a handful that were on the list that were regularly either all pros or things like that. Some of them had long careers, but not careers that would point them to say that they would end up in the Hall of Fame someday. The other one that I thought had sort of an interesting career that, you know, possibly may get some consideration sometime from a senior committee was John Nyland, who played for the Cowboys during the 60s. And he was a guard, 6-time Pro Bowler, 2-time All Pro, excellent pulling guard. He played during both the 66 NFL championship game for the Cowboys that they lost to the Packers, and then also the 67, the famous Ice Bowl. He played in both those games. And he also played for their Super Bowl champions in 71 when they finally beat the Colts in that Super Bowl. So he was another one I thought just credential-wise, you know, the number of, you know, Pro Bowls and all pro seasons. You know, there's some that felt that Gene Lipscomb, Big Daddy, if he had been able to complete his career. And I'll tell his story here, that he might have been Hall of Fame material someday. He is in the Pro Football Researchers Hall of Very Good, which is sort of our designation that we give to some players that haven't made it into the Hall of Fame. And a number of players that made it into our Hall of Very Good have later become Hall of Fame members. He was known as Big Daddy. He played during the 50s and early 60s. He played with the Rams and the Colts and then the Steelers. It was where he finished his career. Three-time Pro Bowler, two-time All-Pro. Sort of a sad story. He grew up in Detroit. His mother was murdered during his childhood. It haunted him for the rest of his life. He tragically, in 1963, at the age of 31, died of a heroin overdose. Some feel it was self-inflicted. Some argue, including Jim Brown, who was a good friend of Big Daddy's, say that he wasn't the type of person that would have done that to himself, even though he had a number of demons throughout his whole life. He played on those two co-championship teams, 58 and 59. He played in the greatest game ever played in 58. He played on that same defensive line with two Hall of Famers, Art Donovan and Gino Marchetti. So he was just, he was a great defensive lineman whose career was cut, was cut short because of the tragedy. But he's one that, who knows if he had been able to complete his career, because he actually, with the Steelers, a couple of years he was with the Steelers, he was having some great seasons, and it was just sad.
One of the greatest nicknames probably of all time too in NFL history.
Big Daddy. Yeah. So he was another one that sort of caught my eye. Another one I just think has a really sort of interesting backstory is Rosie Grier. Rosie was a defensive tackle with the Giants and Rams. He played on the Rams or the Giants, I should say, 56 NFL championship team, which I mentioned earlier. He was a two-time Pro Bowler and a three-time All-Pro. So he was a very good player on the field, but also he had an interesting life off the field. He was 6'5", 285 pounds. And after he finished his career, he became an entertainer for a while. I used to remember seeing him on TV at the time. He actually was a singer. he was a minister for a while, and he became really actively involved in community work. And here's his sort of interesting aside. He was one of Bobby Kennedy's bodyguards.
Really?
And when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles in 68, Rosie Grier was the one that subdued the killer, Sirhan Sirhan.
No kidding.
And he wrestled the gun out of his hands and held him. And so that's sort of an interesting aside. He was one of Bobby Kennedy's bodyguards at that time.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's a great story too.
Yeah. Yeah. And he also at one time wrote a book called Needlepoint for Men. Here's a guy, 6'5", 285 pound pro football player. He was a big enthusiast for Needlepoint. So,
wow, Rosie Grier is full of surprises here.
Rosie Grier. I remember seeing commercials at the time when he would appear on a variety show, and they would always say, and I remember the one because I sort of thought it was comical. I don't know why they said, when Rosie Grier takes a hold of a song, you better watch out or something like that. It was like, and they showed him, big guy here singing and everything. So he was, he had quite a career, for a variety of different things that he did. So I just thought Rosie just, I think, is an interesting story. Another one we got is Steve McMichael, Mongo, who played for the Bears as a defensive tackle, mostly for the Bears, two-time Pro Bowler, All-Pro, played on that great 46 defense in 85, Buddy Ryan's great 46 defense. Of course, won the Super Bowl, considered one of the best single-season teams ever. And went on to have a successful pro wrestling career with a nickname like Mongo. What else would you do? of course, we have another famous Mongo, Alex Karras, obviously, from the Blazing Saddles movie. But Steve McMichael was another one that whose backstory caught my eye. To Bills fans, I know they will remember Fred Smirlis, great nose tackle for 14 years, also played with the Niners and the Patriots, five-time Pro Bowler, five-time All-Pro. Of interest to me, because I'm a Greek American. He's also a Greek of Greek descent. He actually dabbled in starting a political career after his retirement, but didn't really go anywhere with that. But he was another one whose backstory sort of caught my eye. Great name, Rocky Freitas. I hope I'm saying that last name right. He was a one-time Pro Bowler with Detroit. He was a native Hawaiian, and he played tackle. And his real name is Rockne Crowningberg Freitas. I just thought that has to make some kind of all-name team somewhere.
That's for sure.
After he retired from pro football, he had a long career too, which I thought was interesting, in education at the University of Hawaii. So, and then going back to my Alex Karras story, coming back full circle here, Roger Brown. Roger Brown played with the Lions and the Rams, mostly known during the 60s, six-time Pro Bowler, two-time All-Pro. 1962, he was named outstanding defensive lineman. And this, I thought, was an interesting story because I had not heard of it before. He was part of the – of course, we all know that the Detroit has the traditional Thanksgiving Day game they played for years and years and years now. He was part of the 1962 game known as the Thanksgiving Day Massacre, when the Lions beat the Packers 26-14. And you got to remember, this was during the Packers' early run there in the 60s, when they'd already won they lost the 60 championship under Lombardi to the Eagles. Then they won in 61, and they would go on to win in 62. They beat the Packers, but the Lions beat the Packers that day, and they sacked Bart Starr 11 times. Wow. And Roger Brown was in on seven of those sacks. Can you imagine? I was just shocked when I saw that. And his other sort of interesting side story was he appeared in the movie Paper Lion. Again, that's a reference that people of my vintage know what Paper Lion is. But just to tell the story, George Plimpton was sort of a famous author back in the 60s. And actually, he became sort of a personality because he appeared in movies and stuff like that, too. But George Plimpton wrote a series of sort of sports books where he participated in the sport. And then he wrote a book about it. He did one on Pro Golf Tour called The Bogeyman. And he did Paper Lion because he was able to get the Lions organization to agree to allow him to play with the Lions during training camp. And he eventually got into an exhibition game and played one series. Was hilarious what happened to him. I mean, I think he was faced with like a 4th and 40 something by the time he ran his four play series. But they made a movie of the book. And Alan Alda of MASH fame played George Plimpton in the movie. And a number of Lions from that era, if you ever find the movie on a streaming service, it's great to watch because it's great because you see all these players from the 60s. Vince Lombardi is in the movie because he first went to the Packers to see if the Packers would do it. And Lombardi said that they went. But Lombardi appears in the movie with him meeting with Alan Alda as George Plimpton. You know, and making the request if they'll let him do it with the Packers, but Lombardi didn't want to have any part of it. But Roger Brown appears in the movie. Alex Karras is actually the one, I guess he showed his acting ability even back then. He was the one that was sort of the star of the Lions that were in the movie because he appears in a lot of scenes and stuff like that. But it's a great sort of, curio of that time, if you can find it. And I actually, about a couple months ago, found it because my son had never seen it, and we watched it and got a big kick out of it because Alda playing Plimpton was sort of fun to see too, since he went on to obviously become really famous playing Hawkeye in MASH and then going on to a really successful movie career. But Roger Brown was one that I thought had sort of a really interesting story.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And then after that there was, as I said earlier, there was a lot that had guys like Jumbo Elliott, who was a tackle with the Giants, one-time Pro Bowler, played in the 1990 Super Bowl with the Giants. This the Super Bowl where they beat the the Bills on the kick, on the field goal, at the missed field goal at the end.
In the wide right.
Just, you know, he just, Jumbo Elliott, he sort of just jumps out. You know, he didn't really, when you look at it, you know, he was only a one-time Pro Bowler, but I think he had a great name. I think he's one of those kind of guys that everybody sort of remembers of the night. Oh, yeah, Jumbo Elliott. You know, you just remember because of the name. But, you know, as a career-wise, he doesn't necessarily, like, you know, stand out. You know, and that was the thing with a lot of these guys like, Chad Clifton, Fred Miller, Chris Knee. You know, these are guys that, you know, maybe were 2 to 4-time Pro Bowlers with certain teams, maybe played on a Super Bowl championship team, but just didn't rise to that level of say, the cream of the crop. Dwayne Brown's another one who played with the Houston and Seattle, you know, 4-time Pro Bowler, 1-time All-Pro. Flozell Adams, if I pronounce your first name, he played for Nick Saban at Michigan State before Nick Saban went on to all of his success at Alabama. I loved his nickname. He was 6'7", 335 pounds. He is nicknamed the Hotel. And he's a 5-time Pro Bowler, though, offensive tackle with the Cowboys and then 1 season with the Steelers. So, you know, you had a lot of players sort of in that sort of, vein that, you know, don't necessarily like stand out as a best of, or even maybe a secondary group, but with the teams they played for, maybe can make a case for them. You know, obviously some of them played on Super Bowl championship teams, so obviously they were members of a very good teams, you know, but they just don't stand out quite as much as some of the others that we mentioned here tonight.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I have a question for you. I mean, a great selection of players and some great research on them, George. That was excellent. Okay, so we have the 7 Hall of Famers we put on our list.
Six.
Yeah. Well, we put Hutchinson
Motley,
on
there. Motley, Groza, Pace.
Creighton, oh, you're right. You're right. Brown, you're right. 6. I'm sorry.
Hutchinson. And then we talked about a couple that we thought would possibly be Hall of Fame worthy, like Wisniewski and
Nyland.
Nyland and Gene or Big Daddy Lipscomb. You know, so who's in our Hall of Very Good. Yeah.
Okay. So that takes us down. Do we need 2 more by my count to make an even 10, right?
Yeah. I guess if I had to choose 2 more, I think I would go with Roger Brown, the great Lions player.
Okay.
And I think some would probably, you know, disagree with me. I almost feel like I need a 10A, a 10B, and a 10C because I have a hard time choosing between McMichael, Smirlus, and Rosie Greer.
Hey, we can do that because it's our list.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I would say, I think I would say McMichael, Smirlus, and Rosie Greer. You know, I know it's Fred Smirlus. I may have said. I think that's what I said earlier. I hope I pronounced that right.
Yeah, no, yeah, you said it. You said it right on.
Smirlish, yeah. So at any rate, yeah, I think those would be my 10A, B, and C. I just have a hard time picking between those three. I think if you look at his credentials, Smirlish is maybe the best of the three. He played on those Bills teams just prior to them making the Super Bowl run. And I know in reading up on him, a lot of people felt that, you know, he was responsible for, you know, those teams that sort of brought the Bills along to the point to where then they blossomed, you know, in the early 90s with that, with the 4-year Super Bowl run that they had, which, you know, I always say this to people too, you know, those Bills teams, everybody remembers them for losing the 4 Super Bowls, but, you know, that was still one of the great teams in pro football history. I don't care. It's like the Vikings during the early years in the 60s and 70s, the Vikings lost 4 Super Bowls too, but, you know, you got to remember those great Vikings teams. They had the 1 year with Joe Kapp, from the Canadian Football League, was their quarterback. But then they had all those great years with Fran Tarkenton. And, you know, you can't not, with Bud Grant as their coach too, you just, you know, had a number of Hall of Famers, Mick Tinglehoff. You just can't not say that that wasn't a great, you know, team in history. Even though they didn't win the ultimate prize, those are just 2 examples of 2 teams that were really amongst the best ever. And, we're very much about number one, but, you know, those are great teams, you know, and those are just 2 examples. You know, there's others, you know. What if the Cowboys had never started winning Super Bowls, but yet they lost to Vince Lombardi 2 years in a row and 2 of the greatest NFL championship games ever in 66 and then in 67. A lot of people actually feel that even though the ice ball is so well known and renowned, that the 66 championship game was actually even a better overall game because it was, you know, I don't always think greatness needs to be defined by winning the ultimate prize. So,
I agree with you. So, some great teams. When you take home that Lamar Hunt Trophy 4 years in a row, I mean, that's pretty big news. You know,
it is.
Did a great job.
It is.
Ran into some hot teams in the Super Bowl.
They did. It just never quite worked out for them. And then, you know, thinking back to the time too, I think it started getting in their heads a little bit.
I agree. Well, George, that is a great list. And like I said, great research. And we really appreciate you coming on here and helping us out here with this list and giving us some great insight on the history of, first of all, Canton, your home city, all these Ohio players we got to discuss, and a little bit about their high schools in the local areas too, as well as all the other players that you talked about. So I appreciate you coming on once again. Sure. And thank you very much.
Darren, before we quit, I have one story I wanted to tell.
Most certainly.
This is from the Super Bowl weekend, or the Hall of Fame. We're just talking about Super Bowl. Hall of Fame weekend. I just wanted to share this because I just thought it was a fantastic story. I was on the parade route right towards the beginning of the parade on Saturday, about four blocks from the beginning of the parade, right where if people have seen the 11, sort of the first of the 11 is the place where the league was the birthplace of the league, which is basically, it's no longer the building that was the Hupmobile showroom. It's now, I think, the Ohio Power Company, but they actually have a plaque there, and they also have a piece of artwork there, a sort of a sculpture that depicts the birth of the NFL. My son's local radio personality, and he was doing the parade on radio with another personality from the radio station he worked for. And he actually worked for a radio station here in Canton until that was one of his last events, because he's moving to a new radio station starting next week. But I was standing behind him in the little tent that they had set up for the radio station. And Edger and James came by. And those that have been to the parade know that all the enshrinees ride in the parade, normally in most cases with their presenter. Edger and James, obviously, great, you know, running back with the Colts. Jim Irsay, the owner of the Colts, was his presenter and is riding with him. So as they're riding by, I notice, and a number of other people notice, that Jim Irsay pulls out a bag, sort of a blue canvas bag, and reaches into it and starts pulling cash out. And he starts throwing cash at the crowd. And here it turned out that he was throwing $100 bills at the crowd. And he had a bag full of $100 bills. That he was throwing out during the parade. I don't think it's made much, you know, national news. I Googled it today, and I saw that it was mentioned in a couple of places. And I thought this was interesting. I didn't even know this. Apparently, during training camp or something in 2014, he did the same thing at training camp. So we actually talked afterwards to some members of Edger and James' family afterwards, and they were saying it was just a way for them to give back to the community. But we estimated conservatively that there may have been $50,000 worth of $100 bills in that. And I have to say, I've seen many Hall of Fame parades. And when I was a kid, all I ever got was gum and candy. And I certainly didn't get $100 bills. And I didn't move fast enough to get one on Saturday. But I just thought that was just, I thought, one of the great parade stories from this, you know, this past year. I just thought that was just, you know, unbelievable. And they said, once people started seeing it, I looked up as they were going up the street past us, people were starting to converge on that car. I read on one of the social media sites that somebody walked away with like 10 hundreds and people were walking away. Some people maybe won, but it was crazy. I just had to tell the story. I just thought that might be of interest to your listeners.
Yeah, it was.
It was absolutely crazy.
And Edger and James had probably one of the most entertaining speeches of the weekend too, when he was referencing, you know, the hard life he grew up in, and everybody said, you know, he would be in trouble with the law and everything, and he chose to stay on the straight and narrow, and he opened up his gold jacket and said, no, that's why I'm inmate number 357 or whatever his number is, going into the Hall of Fame. So yeah. I thought that was a pretty good line too.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of really good acceptance speeches. Peyton Manning had a good one. Charles Woodson, Calvin Johnson, I thought was one of the best of the weekend. But yeah, there was a number of good ones. But
yeah, I agree.
I'm sorry. I know we were sort of closing shop there, but I wanted to.
No, I'm glad you added that.
I don't think the national audience maybe heard much about it, but it was definitely a buzzing here locally. So I just had to tell that story. I just thought that was something.
Excellent. I'm glad you did, because we needed to hear that. So that's when you hear so many poor things about the owners and the players, and especially Mr. Irsay the last couple of years, he's got some bad press, but yes. Here's something him giving back to the community. That's a good thing.
Yeah, it was really something.
So, well, thank you for sharing that. And thank you for sharing your knowledge and your expertise in the history of football and teaching us all something here today. So thank you very much for that.
Thanks, Darren. Always a thrill to do this.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about sports yesteryear, and so we're so pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings your sports history to life anywhere. The Row One gallery includes over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, advertisements, and more in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. And any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. And in Row One shop, check out the thousands more of you unique items with a retro and historical designs dating back to 1876, including t-shirts, long sleeve shirts, phone cases, mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com, ROW1, for access to the full Row One catalog and for gallery prints and gift items. Plus get a 15% discount off all prints on the Row One Pictorum Gallery with coupon code SHN15. Follow the link on the show notes. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. PigskinDispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.